Edward from McGill, and he will be pandering to the three probable ones in the room, speaking about a liberation process for quantum visual information.
Right, so this is joint work with Nima Lashkari, who's also at McGill, and Tobias Osborne at Royal Holloway. The genesis of this project was actually a conversation that I had with Roland Spiker, who I guess is a free probabilist at Queen's University, and he told me about this notion of free, mutual free information. So it's a notion from free probability, and it struck me as quite a beautiful idea. And so eventually, what we decided to do is to try to import that idea into quantum information theory and see how well it worked. So I could just give you a pure quantum information theory talk, but what I'm actually going to do is I'll start off by just reviewing what the quantum mutual information is, so what it means, why we care about it, and then I'll just give you a very quick tour of basically some definitions and free probability so that you can get an appreciation of where this idea for mutual free information comes from. And then I'll define I'll try to do something analogous to what is done when one defines free mutual information. And what we'll find is that actually in the quantum mechanical context, and we'll find that that actually gives us exactly the quantum mutual information that we're very familiar with. And you'll see that as we go through the story of free probability a little bit, that's a little bit of a surprise because at least it isn't known that anything quite so simple happens in the free probability case. In advance, I would like to apologize to the free probabilists in the crowd for any violence that I do to free probability theory. Again, this is really a quantum information talk, but to appreciate it, I think a little bit of context is useful, but I'll probably get a few things wrong. So, all right, so first, quantifying uncertainty. Before we get to mutual information, we just have to talk a little bit about entropy. I think everyone's on the same page here. If we have a random variable with finite range, then the Shannon entropy of X is just minus the sum over the different possible values of minus p of x log p of x. And we can extend that. It's, of course, a convex function for a Bernoulli random variable. It's maximized when the probability of 1 is equal to the probability of 0 is a half, right? It's maximized at 1 bit. We can extend the function to the quantum mechanical case. This is called the von Neumann entropy, just by replacing, basically by taking the Shannon entropy of the eigenvalues of a density operator. So the von Neumann entropy is h of rho is equal to minus the trace of rho log rho. And of course, then this von Neumann entropy is concave. It's unitarily invariant if we conjugate by rho by unitary, of course. And now just to introduce a little bit of notation, if I have a density operator rho subscript AB, so I'm going to use these subscripts to indicate which systems the density operator acts on. So it acts on the tensor product Hilbert space A tensor B. And I'll write rho sub A for the reduced density operator on the A system, so taking the trace over the B system, and likewise rho sub B and so on. And then I'll introduce this notation, H sub A, I guess the rho got cut off a little bit, but H sub A, or H of A sub rho is just the entropy of the A density operator, and likewise entropy of B. One of the best and simplest and greatest inequalities for this von Neumann entropy is what's known as subadditivity. So simply, the von Neumann entropy of the joint density operator on AB is less than or equal to the sum of the entropies for the two reduced density operators. And there's equality if and only if the state rho AB is a tensor product of its marginals. All right. So entropy has these abstract properties, but it also has a sort of very concrete operational interpretation, which is actually going to be important for us later in the talk, so I might as well throw in a little bit about it right now. So if we have, again, this random variable x, and then we take, n independent, identically distributed independent copies of x, x1 through xn, then we get a string of random variables. So if x is a Bernoulli or binary random variable, we get a string of zeros and ones. And of course, we expect the number of zeros to be about n times the probability of getting a zero, and the number of ones to be about n times the probability of getting a one. And what this means is that if we ask, well, suppose that we take one of these strings at random and ask, what is the probability of one of these random strings, typically? Well, that random string contains, if we look at one of the symbols, like say x is equal to zero, it contains about n times p of x zeros, right? And so the probability of the string is about the product over the different possible values, so the product over 0 and 1, the probability of the letter raised to the number of times the letter occurs. So p of x raised to the power of n times t of x, roughly speaking. Of course, if we just take the p of x and raise it into the exponent, then what we find is that the probability of a random string is nothing other than, roughly speaking, 2 to the power of minus n times the entropy. And that's where that formula for the entropy comes from. It really tells us about sort of the probability of a typical string. And what this means is that the number of typical strings is at most roughly 2 to the n times this entropy quantity again. So out of all possible strings that could have occurred, there are 2 to the n of them, the total number of strings that are really at all likely to occur with any substantial probability is about 2 to the n times the entropy. And I'm dropping a fudge factor that should be appearing here, but I don't want to get into it. And so in the language of compression, what we would say is that if we have n copies of x, then we can compress it to a binary string of length approximately n times the entropy of x. Or in language that may be a little bit more appropriate later on, we can approximate this sequence of independent random variables x1 through xn by a random variable with range whose size is about 2 to the n times the entropy. So we can think of the entropy as being, we could even define it in terms of the smallest set that we need in order to approximate a sequence of independent random variables. Now, I've just described this in the case of classical random variables, but everything carries over essentially almost without change to the quantum mechanical case, because we can apply this notion of compression to a density or to a tensor product of density operators by just acting in the basis that diagonalizes that density operator and projecting onto the subspace spanned by these typical strings instead of just choosing the set. And that's called the typical subspace and the typical projection. All right, so mutual information. You'll remember that I told you one of the greatest and simplest and most useful properties of entropy was its subadditivity. That inspires the definition of quantum mutual classical or quantum mutual information. So this quantity mutual information of AD is just the deficit between the sum of the marginal entropies and the joint entropy. And we know from subadditivity that this quantity is non-negative, and also that it's equal to zero if and only if the state is a tensor product. So it also has lots of other great properties, my favorite of which I should mention, thanks to Beth and Elliot Lieb. So I would call this kind of monotonicity, or it's the strong subadditivity inequality. So if you've heard of strong subadditivity and forget exactly how to write it down with all that combinations of different subsystems, if we have a density operator rho on three subsystems A, B, C, then if we just throw away one of the subsystems, C, that can only decrease the mutual information. And by the sign spring theorem, that immediately gives us a kind of monotonicity property. If we act on one half of a bipartite system by a quantum channel, then we can only decrease the mutual information. And this, again, sort of really helps to motivate the definition of mutual information and show that it's sensible, because it tells us that we can't increase correlation, which is what we're thinking we're measuring by mutual information, by acting locally. Now, again, these abstract characterizations or properties help to motivate the quantity, but what really actually tells us that it's the right thing to think about in many circumstances is that it's the answer to lots of operational questions that we're interested in quantum information. So you've seen this week already that this mutual information quantity, it appears in many different guises. The Halevo quantity of the last talk is actually just a special case of mutual information. In all these channel capacities, the classical capacity of a quantum channel, the entanglement-assisted capacity, various kinds of wiretapping, privacy capacities of channels, channels with multiple inputs, multiple outputs, whatever you want, you always find that the capacity, to the extent that you can analyze it, is described by some kind of region that's controlled by mutual information quantities. And there's also another way of looking at the mutual information, which is kind of saying that if we start with a correlated state, we start with this rho sub AB, how hard do we have to work to turn it into a product state? And I'll get back to that later, because that's going to be very much connected, or very much the spirit of this liberation process. So now, what is free probability? And again, apologies to the free probabilists, but this is a theory that was invented by Voiculescu, And it's essentially an analogy to probability theory, where the notion of independence is replaced by the notion of freeness, essentially freeness as in free group. And the objective there was to resolve problems in the theory of operator algebras. All I can say is that this program, which was really quite visionary and required a substantial persistence, really seems to have been very successful. And this wasn't the motivation at the beginning, but he discovered somewhere along the way that this free probability could be thought of as the limit of certain kinds of, in large D, of certain kinds of D by D random matrices. So let's take that point of view and just explore free probability from that perspective a little bit. So if we have a sequence, A sub D of D by D, call them Hermitian random matrices, and I want to think of, for example, random matrices where the where each entry is say Gaussian with mean zero and variance one, and say we constrain it so that the matrix is Hermitian. These matrices get bigger and bigger, and of course they don't converge to anything in any reasonable sense. But the moments of the matrices potentially do converge, and so we can consider these quantities, say alpha k, which are essentially the limits of the moments normalized by the size of the matrix. And we take the expectation values. So we can organize that information if we want to by saying that we consider the free algebra A script A with a generator A, and we define a state, so a normalized linear functional on the algebra, by just saying that phi of A to the K is equal to this moment alpha sub K, right? So we can always do that because the algebra is generated by the A to the Ks, and the A to Ks are linearly independent. And then we say that the matrices converge to this element of the free algebra in distribution. And so that's just a way of organizing some information. But it's a little bit more interesting if we start to take sequences of pairs of random matrices. So we now have A sub D and A sub B sub D, and they're both members of the same algebra. And we say that the pair converges to a pair of algebra elements, A comma B in distribution, if for all non-commutative polynomials, so essentially all words in X and Y, if we consider the moment that we get by taking, for example, A sub D cubed, B sub D, A sub D squared, and so on, take the trace, that ultimately will converge to phi evaluated in the same way. So A sub, whatever it was, A cubed, B, A squared, and so on. And so not only do we recover the moments individually, but we recover the moments, the products, for products. So that's just a definition. Where does this notion of freeness come in? Freeness is essentially kind of some kind of property that occurs when the variables are independent, the random matrices are independent in the right sense before you take the limit. So if A sub D and B sub D are random matrices of the Hermitian Gaussian type that I was describing before, Wigner showed back in the 1950s that the eigenvalue converges to essentially the eigenvalue distribution converges to a semicircle. And we can say, well, what properties does the limit distribution for the pair of these things have? So A sub D and B sub D converge to variables, S1 and S2, that are free. And that's where this definition of free comes from. So what does it mean to be free? Well, if we take polynomials P1 through PK, and K can be at any number, and they're now variables in one, or they're now polynomials in one variable, and they're polynomials such that when we evaluate them on the appropriate S, we get zero, right? So this is a polynomial in one of the S's, P1 on S of I1. So when we evaluate the state, when we apply the state to P1 of S of I1, we get zero. P2 to S of I2, we get zero, and so on. Then what we want is that when we multiply all these things up, if they were individually zero, then they remain zero when we multiply them out. Provided, of course, that we don't repeat, that if we have S1 here, we have to have S2 here, and then the next one we have to have S1. So we can't, the variables occurring in adjacent polynomials have to be distinct. So that's a little bit, maybe a little bit much to absorb, so let's just think about an example. So here's a polynomial in A minus phi of a times the unit, right? So if we evaluate the state on that, then we clearly get zero, right? Because phi acting on A minus phi acting on phi of A1 is just phi of A minus phi of A is zero, right? So here's a polynomial that is is centered, right? When we evaluate it with phi, we get zero. Likewise for B, and so the freeness condition tells us that when we evaluate phi on the product, we have to get zero also. But if you expand this out, what it tells us is that phi of AB has to be phi of A times phi of B. This actually looks a lot like independence for classical commutative random variables, right? That is almost the same condition. However, it's very different than independence because if we consider now another example, do the same thing for a product of A, these A's and the B's, A's and the B's again. You expand that one out, and what you find is that evaluating the moment for AB, AB has this particular form. And you'll notice that if these were commutative, independent variables, what we would have gotten is just phi of A squared times phi of B squared, right? And so something very different is occurring. However, it behaves very much like independence in the sense that if we want to calculate any joint moments of these A's and B's, then we can always express them in terms of polynomials of the moments of the A's and the B's individually. Ultimately, free probability gives us a way of systematically calculating any joint moments of free random variables. And in fact, it can be proven that there are essentially only two types of rules that you can use to organize moments in this way, either independence or free independence. And I've just given definitions, but the theory really develops very much like classical probability theory and gives you very powerful tools for calculating. So for example, it leads to a formula that can be used for calculating the limiting eigenvalue distribution of a sum of large random matrices, something called the free convolution. And the theory, there are central limit theorems in the theory and so on and so forth. All right, so now that you have some notion of random variable, it's natural to try to develop some notion of entropy. And the way that Voicălescu proceeded was he thought the crucial property of entropy was of Shannon entropy was the fact that it essentially described the size of a set required to approximate a sequence of independent, identically distributed random variables. It was this approximating property. And so he proceeded by analogy and said, okay, well now, he's going to define the free entropy, chi of AB, for two non-commutative random variables A and B. And it's going to be related to the size of the set of matrices required to approximate these non-commutative random variables. So there's a set, you can consider a set gamma, which is actually going to be parametrized by various things like the size of the matrices, some parameter epsilon, which tells you how good your approximations are, the degree of the polynomials that you care about with respect to these moments. Gamma is going to be the set of all Hermitian matrices for which you approximate all of those moments, of bounded degree, sufficiently well. And there are actually some extra conditions and cutoffs that I've left out, but that's the spirit of the thing. And the free entropy is defined by a careful limiting procedure involving taking the log of the Euclidean volume of this set of matrices that you use to approximate. So very much the same thing as is done with Shannon entropy, where the Shannon entropy really is the logarithm, properly normalized, of the size of the set required to approximate a sequence of random variables. So it has lots of useful properties, but for our purposes, one of its most relevant properties is that this free entropy satisfies subadditivity, just like the Shannon or the von Neumann entropies do. And so if you have a pair of random variables, AB, then the free entropy of AB is less than or equal to the sum of the free entropies for the individual variables. And again, you have equality if and only if they're free. Assuming, of course, that these chi's are actually positive, meaning that you can properly approximate the non-commutative random variables by matrices. So this would lead to a natural candidate for mutual free information, right? So we have some subadditive entropy quantity, and we could just do exactly the same thing that is done with the von Neumann entropy and say, well, the mutual information, free mutual information, is now going to be chi of A plus chi of B minus chi of AB, right? Because we know this is greater than or equal to 0, and equal to 0 if and only if these variables are free. But that's actually not how Voicalescu proceeded. At least one reason was that he wanted to be able to define this quantity when the individual free entropies are themselves not defined. This problem of them being minus infinity crops up quite a bit. And so he made the following observation, that if you have these two non-commutative random variables, A and B, and you take U hard distributed, then A and U B U conjugate, or U adjoint, I should say, are free. And so you can say that U, this hard unitary, liberates B from A. Right? So given two non-commutative random variables that might not be free, you can make them free by conjugating one of them by a hard unitary. And now here, hard unitary, you can just think of it as, again, in the random matrix language, some kind of limit of a sequence of hard random unitary matrices. Of course, this liberation of B from A, that might be really overkill, right? Because it could have been that A and B were free to begin with, right? And so this conjugation by the random unitary didn't actually contribute at all to their, you know, to making them free. And so instead what you could say is, all right, well, let's start a Brownian motion, free Brownian motion, so at the identity, and ask how long it takes for A and U of T be U of T conjugate to become free, right? And it's going to take longer, presumably, for variables that are further away from free. And so the amount of time it takes this process to actually free the variables gives us some measure of how unfree the variables were to begin with. And I'm not going to go into more details than that, but based on that idea, you can define the mutual free information, which he denoted by I star. Now, a crucial point is that, at least as far as I know, and I asked some free probabilists here, there's no known relationship between I star, as defined this way with this liberation process, and what we would have thought of just as information theorists as the natural definition based on the free entropy. No connection known. And what we'll see actually is in the quantum mechanical case, that's precisely the connection that can be made. So here's just, I'm afraid it didn't come out very well, but something that I scanned in from a review paper that Voicalescu wrote, in which he was describing essentially his, a review paper on free entropy, and he was describing his motivation for this definition of free, mutual free information. And he basically says that this liberation process type idea that he came up with, there's no way to do it for regular random variables, that there's some kind of extra structure available in the free probability case that allows you to construct this liberation process. What we're going to see is that, at least in a limited sense, it can be done, but maybe in a way that he wasn't anticipating. And just by virtue of the fact that I'm tremendously impressed by whatever intuition led him to this notion of liberation process, because it turns out that even in the case of quantum mutual information, it leads to exactly, it seems, to the quantities that that we're familiar with. Even though, as far as I can tell, it hadn't been defined anywhere before, and he didn't see how to define it in the case of regular mutual informations. So now let's look at the liberation process for quantum mutual information. And what are we going to do? So we have a bipartite density operator, rho sub AB, and remember that the mutual information is equal to zero if and only if that joint density operator rho sub AB is equal to the product of its marginals. And so what we want is a process that will, quote, decouple A from B, right? It will somehow turn this density operator, which is not a product, into one that is a product. Now, how can we do that? Well, if we let C be, again, a Hilbert space that we'll call an ancilla space, and we start off that state C in some pure state, it doesn't matter which one, so I've just called it zero, and then we let a Haar distributed unitary act on B and C together, right? So we have the identity acting on A, and then this Haar distributed unitary acting on B and C. Well, that's going to sort of mix up the information present in B and C in a sort of isotropic way, And if C is big enough, right, so if C is big enough that it can kind of absorb all of the information that was present in B, that when you trace over the C system, right, when you ignore the C system, then what's left on A and B is going to be close to product. And so this is the analog, or at least one analog, of Voicalescu's suggestion to take variables that aren't necessarily free, and you make them free by conjugating by a hard unitary. Here you take a density operator that isn't necessarily a product, and you make it a product by interacting with the ancilla and then throwing the ancilla away. Of course, like in Voicalescu's case, this might be overkill, because we might have started off with a state that was already a product. And so this whole procedure of interacting with the ancilla and throwing the ancilla away left it approximately a product, but didn't help. And so, again, inspired by Voicalescu, we do the same thing. So we replace this hard distributed unitary U by a Brownian motion in the unitary group. And we just ask, how long does it take to decouple A and B using this Brownian motion process? It starts off at the identity, and so if they were already product at the beginning, then right away they're product. And if they're only weakly correlated, then hopefully they'll decouple sooner. And now, in order to get mutual information out, unfortunately, we have to do things that are slightly more complicated than what I just described. So what we'll do, any time that you want to get von Neumann entropies or Shannon entropies out, you need to talk about many copies of something. And so we have our density operator rho AB. We're going to take n copies of that density operator. We'll adjoin the ancilla, and the dimension of the ancilla space is just imagine it as sufficiently large. So each of these density operators, so I want to think of each of these lines here as being some quantum system. So the purples are the A's, and the greens are the B's. Okay, so we're not going to act on the A's. Remember, the liberation process acts on B and C. So we're just going to move all the A's over, and then the B's are going to participate. And here's the part where that isn't entirely satisfying. The first step is going to be that we compress the B system. So just the compressions that I was talking about at the beginning, so essentially we project onto the subspace band by the typical eigenvectors of rho B. I think this step might not be essential, but doing everything without this step is actually much more difficult. So for the time being, we'll do violence to the sort of symmetric definition by compressing this way. And then we run this unitary Brownian motion on the compressed B system and the C's. And then we just ask, okay, well, the output, call it sigma AB, is that a product or not? Or how close is it to a product? And we'll let T of N and epsilon be the minimum time required before the expectation value of sigma AB minus the product state sigma A tensor sigma B is less than or equal to epsilon. And we'll use the trace norm here because that's quantum information theorist's favorite norm is the norm of statistical distinguishability. What happens? Well, something reasonably good happens. In the limit that n goes to infinity, this time divided by n, because it takes longer the more states we have, is less than or equal to precisely the quantity that we're interested in, the mutual information. Of course, if this is supposed to be a characterization of mutual information, it shouldn't just be less than or equal to, it should be actually equal to. And that's just an indication that this work is slightly premature, but I figured that I don't get many chances to speak to operator algebraists, and the next one would probably come around in 2 years. And so it's slightly premature, but I think that we can probably actually fill in the gap there and make that equality. In the meantime, we can offer a slightly more stringent definition of decoupling, which isn't operationally motivated, but gives us the right answer. And so we'll let T sub 2 be the minimum time required before this condition is met. So essentially, instead of talking about this trace norm, we talk about how mixed the state is as measured by its second moment, right? Because if a state is pure, then the trace of that state squared is just 1. If it's the uniform state on dimension D, then the trace of the state squared is going to be 1 over D. And so this quantity gives us some measure of how mixed the state is. And as the state becomes product, this quantity that we call the purity is going to approach the purity of the product state. And if we want to approach the product state purity multiplicatively, then what we find is that The minimum time before which this happens is precisely the quantum mutual information that we were looking for. So how does one go about actually demonstrating such a thing? So we did this by sort of setting up the process as a stochastic differential equation and then seeing where that led us. And so we start off with Brownian motion in the traceless d by d Hermitian matrices. So let the x alphas be orthonormal elements for the Lie algebra SUD. And what you do is you just say, okay, well, you start a Brownian motion where the coefficients for each of these orthonormal elements of the Lie algebra are just independent Brownian motions themselves, right? So so little steps that are Gaussian steps in such a way that this process W of alpha at time t is just normally distributed with variance t. And of course, that leaves open the question, how should you normalize this process? How quickly should it spread out? And of course, you have to normalize it properly because we have various dimensions involved. We have that system C that we're interacting with, that ancilla system, and we don't want the rate at which this process occurs to depend on the size of the ancilla system. And it turns out that the appropriate thing to do by just making sure that you bound the norm properly is that you set the normalization equal to 1 over the dimension. So then, once you have Brownian motion in the Hermitian matrices, which are the Lie algebra of the unitaries, then you can just exponentiate to get a stochastic differential equation for the time evolution of the Brownian motion process in the unitary group, which is nice and compact. And we stumbled across this, but I was quite gratified when I was checking these things recently to find out that that's a standard stochastic differential equation, so we hadn't gone off the rails. And we'll just define now rho sub ABC, so on the three systems, to be precisely that what we get when we take the input density operator, adjoin an ancilla, and then act by the Brownian motion process. The quantities that we're actually going to study are purities, these quantities trace of rho squared for some rho acting on some particular subsystems. So in particular, we're going to look at A and B. That's actually the one we're interested in, right? Because we're interested in whether or not we decouple on the systems A and B. But it turns out that it's useful to also consider the purity on A and C, so the system that we don't touch and the ancilla. And repeated applications of what's called Itô's rule, which is just essentially the chain rule for these stochastic differential equations, ultimately leads to something that looks kind of ugly, where we get df and dg. So df can be expressed in terms of some ugly stuff, some commutators of the density operator contracted with some of the generators and so on. But then what happens afterwards is more benign. I'm using these capital letters B and C, some abusive notation. Those are quantum systems, and those are the dimensions of those systems. So 1 over the dimension of B, 1 over the dimension of C, and so on. So the liberation process does nothing to the A system, if you remember, right? And so this trace of rho A squared is just a constant. Likewise, the evolution on A, B, and C together is just unitary, right? So trace of rho A, B squared, A, B, C squared is a constant. And then otherwise, well, things look okay. So the only problem is this stochastic part in the beginning. But we're going to be just interested in how the expectation values of these purities evolve over time. And when we take expectation values, things become a lot simpler. So F bar and G bar indicate the expectation values of F and G. And the stochastic parts just go away because this Brownian motion process doesn't have any drift. It's mean zero. So my probability of going left or right is equal. And so when I take expectation values, this part goes away. And what we're left with is actually just a system of ordinary differential equations for the expectation values of these purities, and they're actually linear ordinary differential equations. And so there's no problem to solve these for the evolution of the purities over time. And what you find, for example, is that if you want to calculate the expectation value of the Hilbert-Schmidt norm squared of the density operator on rho AB compared to a product state, which is essentially the product state that it converges to, then that can be expressed in terms of the expectation value of F minus some constant and bounded fairly easily in terms of 1 over C. So remember, C is the ancilla space, so it's 1 over the dimension of the ancilla space, which we're just going to make tremendously large, so that goes away. Exponential decay, and the initial purity. So something really very simple, right? It's essentially just exponential decay times the initial purity. And the constant in that exponential decay doesn't depend on anything, right? It's just two. So it doesn't depend on the dimensions. It doesn't depend on the initial states. Really very simple behavior. And just using the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, we can then relate that to the trace norm, which is the one that we actually care about. And when we do that, we pick up a dimensional factor, right? So rho AB is a density operator acting on the A system and the B system. And so when we go from the Hilbert-Schmidt norm to the trace norm, we pick up an extra factor of the dimension of A times the dimension of B. Okay, so that was a version of the liberation process where we only looked at one copy of the state. We actually have to do the asymptotics now for many copies. We want to look at this version. And we actually want to just prove this result that called the liberation time is no more than the mutual information. So this is a pretty standard quantum information type argument. The first thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to let psi prime be a purification of rho AB. So purification means it's a pure state on a larger system such that when we trace over that extra system, the extension, which I've called D here, we get back rho AB. And I'm going to imagine compressing the n-fold tensor product of psi prime. And I'll call the compressed version psi. And when I say compress, I compress everything in sight, right? So there are three subsystems, A, B, and D, which means that there are three density operators, the density operator on A, the density operator on B, the density operator on D. And so I perform the projections onto typical subspaces for each of those. But I'm just doing this in my head. This is kind of imaginary. For all delta and n sufficiently large, what we find is that this compression process really doesn't alter the state very much. It leaves it almost invariant. But it simplifies things for us. And what we'll do is just check to see whether the decoupling process works on psi, on this compressed version of the state, instead of the one that we actually care about, which I've labeled sigma here. So the one we actually care about, we've only compressed the B system. We haven't compressed these other systems. Because the trace norm is monotonic for completely positive trace preserving maps, just using the triangle inequality, if we can show that we decouple properly for psi, that means that we also have to decouple properly for sigma. And that means that this process will have worked. So the quantity from the previous slide that came up, our upper bound on how well we actually decoupled, was this funny quantity, right? A times B times 1 over C, blah, 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 blah. That the trace norm difference was less than, in expectation, was less than or equal to that. So once we've performed this compression, we can perform various substitutions here. The dimension of A, once A is compressed, is just the rank of psi A, right? The rank of the compressed state on A. The dimension of the B system is the rank of psi B. And the overall state, psi prime was a purification of rho AB, which means that the trace of rho AB squared is the same as the trace of psi D squared. Because psi D and and rho AB have the same non-zero eigenvalues. All right, so we have this expression, and now we can actually just use the standard properties of typical states and projections to replace those quantities by entropic quantities. The first two, so what is the rank of psi A? Remember, the size of the space required to approximate by ID random variables was given by 2 to the n times the entropy. So the dimension of the space required to approximate psi prime tensor n is nothing other than 2 to the n times the entropy of A. The dimension of the space required to approximate B is 2 to the n times the entropy of B. And then what about the trace of psi AB squared, or trace of psi D squared that we have right here? Again, using the identification, it's trace of psi AB squared. And once we've done the typical projection, the eigenvalues are essentially uniform, which means that the trace of a uniform 1 over D matrix and D by D squared gives you nothing other than 1 over D. So we get 2 to the minus n times the entropy. We substitute those in, and what do we have? Well, in the exponents, we have entropy of A plus entropy of B minus 2T minus entropy of AB, which is, of course, the quantum mutual information. And so what we see is precisely that after a time, ignoring the constants, after time t is equal to quantum mutual information times n, then we've actually precisely decoupled these systems using this quantum liberation process. And I've shown you the one half of the inequality in the case of this trace norm, but you can the tighter version where you get exactly the mutual information is actually slightly easier to prove. So what have we done? Well, inspired by Voicalescu's liberation process, we've managed to actually come up with a new way of characterizing quantum mutual information. Unfortunately, at the moment, the tight characterization is only works for a kind of artificially strong definition of what it means to be to liberate. And so what we'd really like to do is push forward and get both sides of the proof in the case of the trace norm. And so here's a rhetorical question, of course. Is anyone here good at the asymptotics of random matrices? And I know the answer is yes, as you'll see in the next two talks. And so I may rely on some of the expertise in the audience to try to finish this thing. Something that I haven't mentioned here is that there's related work. And in fact, it's well known that you can characterize the quantum mutual information in terms of the amount of work required to be done in order to start with a correlated state, that rho AB, maybe tensor N, and then turn it into a decoupled state. So for example, Groisman, Popescu, and Winter showed a few years ago that the minimum number of noise bits that you need to inject in order to decouple two quantum systems using local actions is precisely the mutual information, or the rate is the mutual information. And so one strategy for finishing off this proof that we haven't been able to finish yet, the step that we need to perform is to show that the liberation process doesn't decouple faster than we think it does, would be to show that this liberation process can inject at most 2 log base 2 of E bits of noise per unit time. So if we could show that, then that would mean that we actually, that we have a precise characterization of the quantum mutual information using the liberation process in precisely the sense that we're looking for. And so a final comment, in that scan from Voicalescu's paper, what he was really saying is that there was no there's no natural infinitesimal way to describe the mutual information. He provided a natural infinitesimal definition of mutual free information. We haven't quite succeeded in doing that here, precisely because the first step of the liberation process is to compress the B system, right? So we had this violent step, which isn't sort of the gradual and smooth Brownian motion. We had this violent step which consists of a compression. And so just thinking about it recently, I'm quite optimistic that that step can be eliminated. Unfortunately, the calculations again become more complicated because you have to calculate essentially because the state that you're aiming for, the decoupled state, is now much more complicated than it was in the version that I described here. But nonetheless, I think all of these I hope that all of these things will actually work out. And so this is an example, I guess, free probability was invented, taking its inspiration from probability theory and ultimately solving problems in operator algebras and then having lots of influence in random matrices. And here we have an example of a kind of funny full circle going on where the inspired by probability, Voicalescu came up with a new definition of mutual, a new way of defining a mutual information, which re-imported back into the natural setting here, which I think is quantum mutual information, seems to give us exactly what we're familiar with. So thanks for your attention.